$27 million.
Mr. Gerken, can you answer that?
Mr. Chairman, on the Bradfield Road, that is our number. On the Whittier number, that number has been bandied about for quite some time. There are many options about different kinds of improvements to the tunnel. The number that we did in the 1986 report for the tunnel improvements alone was about $24 million. So our sense is that that's low compared to the studies which we've done in prior years. Now, there are some new tunneling techniques, some new ventilation techniques, and I can't say that we are expert in those, but people who are have told us that there are some new techniques available which will significantly lower the cost of those tunnel improvements. A part of what we would do in our toll feasibility analysis for that project is take another look at those capital costs, because as I said before, you ultimately have to match the optimum revenue with the optimum cost to see what you can do. Take another look at that, but I can't tell you better than that where that $27 million comes from.
I guess it's kind of a guess, but what I don't want to see happen is where, because we authorized $27 million worth of debt, that makes the project unfeasible. If people get out there and get that money to pay, we have a tendency that that'll what it will be. I get $7 million, I would hate to see it just floating for extra things and find out that the people of Whittier can't afford the tolls to cover the bonded debt. So I guess I got my answer to guess.
It's the best estimate and a guess, a ballpark figure. Is that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think that's one way to put it. The other thing to think about is that the toll feasibility study ultimately has to go out to the financial community, and they're going to make their own assessment about what they're willing to pay for and what they think people are willing to pay in terms of the toll. I think really what you do here is you've got a real-world economic test that you're going to put both these projects to. And my sense of having dealt with financial institutions is that they're not going to lend you more than they think that you need or more than they think you can pay back.
Mr. Chairman, wait,
Senator Fisher.
You could have a situation, though, where the project would still be $27 million and the bond, people want to buy the bond, say that's fine, we go 20, but let the state match it with the 7, and that's what may happen with the things, which may be all right if the money's available.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gerken. Any other comments? Senator Frank?
Are you looking for a motion, Mr.
Yeah.
Chairman? Okay, I would move that we pass out CS for House Bill number 311, individual recommendations along with the accompanying fiscal notes.
Okay, is there objection to that? So ordered. Next bill on the calendar, we've got a couple more here. Senator Frank's bill, an act relating to the inspection of boilers and pressure vessels. Is that ready to go?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman. Are we still on teleconference?
Okay, I think we're off the teleconference now. Thank you for the City of Whittier for sitting in on this.
What were we doing?
Boiler inspector?
Yeah, 492.
492.
Turn up the heat
if you need to. We have Tom Stewart here, if there are any questions for Tom Stewart.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I would just introduce the bill by saying that this issue was brought to my attention by our Fairbanks Municipal Utility System. They have several boilers, and they were looking for a greater flexibility in boiler inspections, and there is an organization throughout the state of people that maintain boilers all across the state. The Sitka Pulp Mill, as an example, is also very interested in this, and they have a statewide organization. And apparently there is a code adopted for the installation of new boilers, there's also a code that can be adopted for the inspection of existing boilers once they're installed to the national codes. And this bill would authorize the department to adopt the national code, National Board Inspection Code. You can see here I have my little prop. It would allow greater flexibility in testing boilers. The authority and the responsibility to inspect the boilers still is maintained with the Department of Labor. The Department of Labor cannot do this right now. They can't adopt this code without statutory authority, and they do support the bill. They would appreciate the additional flexibility as well that adopting the National Board Inspection Code would give them. And if there are any questions, I would attempt to try to answer them or have the other people.
Have you read that?
Senator Fisher?
Yes, I haven't read it, but I've reviewed it.
Senator Fisher?
My question centers around something that's referred to sometimes as the plumbing code also, where why would we say the 89 edition, why just not say the most current? So that as technology changes, we're not locked into an 89, as we are with the plumbing code, I understand. They don't want to go to plastic. They want to keep the lead and that kind of pipe in existence.
That's right.
Because once you go to plastic, the plumbing will be out of work. So they keep that old code. Why would we plug ourselves into an 89 code? Why just not the most current?
That's certainly a legitimate question. I'm not sure that I know the answer to that, although I suppose you could say that that we should review the code and not just automatically adopt it without without some review. Now, that review should be it should be based on something other than our impression or something. But if the industry comes to us and says we'd like to see the adoption of a new code, which they have in this case, and the department supports it, I don't see any problem in adopting the new code from time to time. I'm not sure I have a good answer as to why we didn't just say the most recently adopted, but I would be happy to address that and see what the department would say about that.
Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to comment. I don't know if I have a better answer, but we do this, like with the electrical code also. We do this whenever they come out with a new code. We formally adopt it instead of just saying the most recent. I think it's because there should be some review by the state to be sure that they haven't thrown a zinger in there somewhere. For example, plumber's code is a good example. The plumbers don't like the most recent.
Yeah, and then it has about 10 between the plumbers and the general consumer.
Sure. Sure, but I think that's probably the reason why.
Mr. Chairman, I guess it cuts both ways. I would hate to have us adopt the National Wetland Standards and take the most recent version of that every time the federal government changes it or something like that. I mean, it can be bad or it can be good. And you cite a good example of a situation where. Where I think we've probably not addressed current need, but I don't see that as being a problem in this particular case.
And the reason I say that is, for example, in the food service business, the DEC automatically accepts anything that has an NSF label, and they continuously upgrade things. They don't have to come back here each year for us. I mean, they just say, well, that's going to be accepted by the state, no matter what their codes are, whatever, we're just going to buy it. That seal on it, we automatically approve.
They still eat boilers.
No, I don't know if they do it.
Senator Frank, didn't you have some amendments on it, or wanted to put an amendment on it?
No, I think we took care of that back in the Labor and Commerce Committee.
Okay, the Labor and Commerce version is the one that we have before us, is it not?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Frank?
Thank you. Are you looking for a motion?
Yes,
a motion,
Frank.
Okay. Is there any other questions?
Unless you wish to hold it subcommittee.
No, I don't wish to hold it. Mr. Chairman, then I would move that we pass out CS for Senate Bill number 492, Labor and Commerce, with individual recommendations along with the accompanying zero fiscal note.
Okay, is there objection? So ordered. We have the next bill for Senator Zaroff on the calendar, Senate Bill 205. And we do have to get to the AHFC bill today, too. Carl, did you want to testify on 205?
Yes,
Mr. Chairman. Here's Brent. Not here, we can't move it out.
No. Probably not.
I'm just kidding.
No, I'm not.
Well, you're not. I didn't say that.
Carl, why don't you go ahead and start?
Okay. For the record, my name is Carl Olds, a legislative assistant for Senator Zaroff. CS for Senate Bill 205 would establish a new system of calculating shore leases for set net fishing sites, and extends to shore leases the same principle that is now used in setting fees for commercial fishing licenses entry permit renewals, hunting and trapping licenses, and university tuition. In other words, it establishes a different set of fees for residents and non-residents. And the reasoning behind this, as outlined in the legislative findings of Section 1, is that the residents of the state of Alaska year-round bear the costs and obligations of operating state government programs, including the Tidelands Lease Program. The state is justified in charging non-residents a differential that compensates the state for the administrative costs and administrative expenses that non-residents impose on state government. The original bill provided for charging non-residents a flat fee five times over the fee charged to residents. In the Senate Judiciary Committee, questions were raised about possible constitutional problems, and Assistant Attorney General Tom Custer provided us with a new draft that he felt would avoid the constitutional problems. His draft was adopted as the Resources Committee proposed CS. His approach was to divide the annual rental fee into two components. One component is a flat revenue-generating component set at $115 that both residents and non-residents would pay. Everybody pays that. The second component is the administrative cost component. And the way that's set up is residents would pay one-fifth of the costs and non-residents the full amount. And the reasoning behind this is that residents are subsidized because of their year-round contribution to the operation of the state program. In addition, the Division of Land and Water Management in the Department of Natural Resources will be able to use this bill to restructure its fee program for Thailand's leases so that the program can pay for itself. According to some figures that the Department of Natural Resources provided, currently under the present rent rate, the total revenue derived is $165,000. With this bill, they'd restructure the program and raise $212,500. So that about handles it. Larry Ostrowski is here from Department of Natural Resources. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Senator Fisher?
Are you talking strictly set-net leasing, or are we also talking leasing, I'm sure it is, or fixed profit?
Our intention is strictly set-net sites.
Okay, did we have someone from Department of Natural Resources, Larry? Did you wish to testify on the bill?
Just for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, does the Department of Natural Resources support the bill?
We support the bill as written.
Okay. Any questions for Larry? Senator Pierce has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the letter from your commissioner to Senator Fahrenkamp, dated February 26th, which is in our packets, you had some recommended language not establishing fees for both non-residents but also for residents. And I note that there's new language in the CS resources on page 2, lines 3 through 8, which speaks to establishing and revising the fees. It's different from what the commissioner had asked for, and I'm just wondering if the language that's in the present CS is adequate to meet your concerns.
I don't have the letter in front of me, but I know the language that's in the bill presently is fine with the division.
Okay.
I believe that the change was done there to give, if I recall the correct language was put in there to give the division some discretion to change the fees if necessary in the future to meet changing costs of the program. That was the recommended change in Senate Resources.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Larry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You ready for a motion? I guess it's Resources Committee Substitute. I'd move Resources Committee Substitute.
Is there objection to moving the Resources Committee Substitute with a $210,000 positive fiscal note? So ordered. Next bill on the calendar will come from Subcommittee Senate Bill 427. Senator Rohde will join us at the table. Appreciate you being so patient this morning. Senator Frank and Senator Pierce and Senator Binkley worked on this on a committee substitute. So, Senator Frank, did you want to explain that, or did you want
to? Well, Mr. Chairman, I would defer to Senator Rohde to explain those. I think we did work out good language that will give the flexibility to HFC, the railroad, and the Alaska State Housing Authority to to conduct their procurement in a manner that's in the spirit of the procurement law, i.e., one that's fair to the public, to the vending public, and competitive, and lowest, good procurement philosophy, but would allow them the flexibility to meet market needs, to do things that they needed to do to save money. And Mr. Chairman, I think it's good language, and we also changed the language.
Can you go through there's about two or three sections on the bill that are changed so that we know? Senator Rohde, can you do that?
Be happy to do that, Mr. Chairman. Senator Frank's very modest. The committee did an excellent job on this bill and solved the two knottiest problems, the Procurement Code and the Executive Budget Act. The Executive Budget Act exemption was stricken, and in its place language was replaced, which said the board shall promptly submit a resolution adding any employees it thinks is necessary to the Budget and Audit Committee, and the Budget and Audit Committee has 45 days after receipt of the board's resolution to terminate any of the people that the HFC board has put on. That meets the need of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. It meets the need of the legislature and the Budget and Audit Committee with regard to oversight.
Senator Duncan.
Oh, on that specific point, I want to ask.
Right. As soon as he was finished with that point, I was going to let you answer that.
I'm finished, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, that's on page 2 now, is it not?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Section 2.
Page 2, section 2. Senator Duncan on that section.
Yeah, I see the language there, and it from a legislative viewpoint, it seems to be to make sense. I'm just wondering, though, has this been checked? Because I know before, we've had court suits over the power of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, and it was determined that we could not have veto power over agency action or executive branch action, and this more or less does give us the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee veto power over actions taken by HFC, because what it says very clearly that if LBNA disapproves the resolution, that they have to terminate the employees. And I thought that we'd gone through that battle before, and that type of review could not be designated to the LBNA committee.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chenoweth of our legal staff has approved this, and he is certainly our most constitutionally minded lawyer. The effect is no different than having the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee approve it because of the difficulty during the off session in securing a quorum on LBNA. This was felt to be the preferred method.
Senator Duncan.
Well, I personally don't have a problem with this, but I guess the way the LBNA committee works now, for example, when the executive branch submits a revised program to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, we can recommend that they don't go ahead with that program. However, the administration, we cannot mandate that the administration take the LBA recommendation. They can ignore our recommendation and do what they want to do and explain why. This, though, says that this agency has to take the LBA recommendation and terminate the employees. And I'm just wondering if Mr. Chenoweth looked at that. It seems to me to fall along the line of the court case that we had when Hammond was governor about what are proper duties and powers of LBNA and what can be designated to them.
Through the chair, I will double check with Mr. Chenoweth on that. And as you correctly point out, Senator, it's suggested that AHFC could do this now. However, they have not, and this was felt to be acceptable language from all quarters.
Senator Frank. Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think I was modest enough in my opening remarks. I think we got a problem. I think Senator Duncan is correct, and I've asked Janice to have Mr. Chenoweth come over, because I am personally under the impression that LBNA can't do that because of that court suit, Legislature v. Hammond. And I guess I'd like him to explain it. When we last met, we had left instructions, I thought, that were just notification to the Budget and Audit Committee. And I think that perhaps we miscommunicated if Mr. Chenoweth thought that we meant that Legislative Budget and Audit Committee would have a veto power, because unless I'm mistaken, I was under the impression that the Budget and Audit Committee couldn't delegate its authority to terminate positions to the LBNA committee. I think that's the whole crux of the issue, is the delegation of the entire legislature of its authority to the LBNA committee. And I think we're going to find we're going to have to take that last sentence out of there.
Which sentence is that? What line is
that? The last sentence, starting on line number 10, mm-hmm. going through the end of line 13.
On page 2?
Right. I think we're going to get down to the point where we just have to provide notification to the Budget and Audit Committee. And then the full legislature in its next budget cycle can accept or reject that sort of... Is that what Jack said?
Senator Duncan.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that.
Senator Duncan is now one up on me on legal questions. I won the last one, so it's your turn.
I guess one further point on that is that I don't believe right now that even the full legislature can approve or disapprove position counts, number of positions. So I'm not even
sure when the legislature comes back in session,
we have the ability to tell HFC that they can't create positions.
That's true.
I mean, Mary's
we can,
back
we can, Mary's back there, and of course, Mary, of course, is obviously our expert on the legislature, right? So she works for the governor.
I think you're right.
Okay, Pat, while we wait for Jack Chenoweth to come over here, why don't we go? Oh, he's not coming over now?
Mr. Chairman.
Well, then what's the problem here? Senator,
I'm going to recommend that we just delete that last sentence, and I think we've got what we intended if we delete that. I do not believe we intended to have veto power, even, you know, regardless of whether or not we could legally. We did not really intend that, and so if we take that last sentence out, which states, if within 45 days after receipt of the board's resolution, the committee disapproves the resolution, the board shall immediately terminate the persons employed under the resolution.
Okay.
If we take that sentence out, I think we can pass the bill out without any problem.
Okay, but the question is, I mean, despite the Budget and Audit Committee's ability to do whatever they need to do here, we still, the HFC still has to come before the legislature every year, does it not?
Annually, yes.
Yes.
So we're not changing anything there. We're not changing anything as far as it being in the front of the budget or anything of that nature, right, Senator Rohde?
That is correct.
Okay, Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we should hear from Mary, but that whole paragraph then, it says, I'm not sure why we're saying in law, if the Board of Directors determines it is in the best interest of the corporation may employ additional employees without obtaining prior approval of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. I mean, that's understood.
It's true.
Mr. Chairman, I'll let Ms. Halloran answer, but as you know, Senator Duncan, it's thought that AHFC and other state agencies have this power now. We're restating here specifically for AHFC that they have the authority to use it. They have not used that authority in the past. It's clear we need to give them that authority if we're to avoid some fairly significant losses from management. So
we're just trying to make make clear
what is probably the law anyway.
Okay. Well, maybe that's okay. Can we hear from Mary just...
Yes. So your suggestion is to take off that sentence?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, let's just do that informally here. What, we start on line 9 or 10?
Line 10, beginning
starting
of the
word if.
Yes. And going through line 13 after the word resolution.
All right. Okay, we'll still get to the adoption of it. If you want to adopt the...
I would adopt our move that we adopt CS for Senate Bill number 427, Finance.
Okay, any objection to that? So ordered.
And then I would move that we... delete the sentence beginning on line 10, starting with the word if, and ending on line 13, ending with the word resolution.
That's fine. If there's no objection to that, so ordered.
Yeah.
But one of the things I want to bring to your attention, and I guess we'll be okay because we aren't making an exemption from the Executive Budget Act, but in the case of like the executive director's salary, I don't have any pros or cons against what it's going to be. But it did seem like they did put in a large increase in there for his salary, and I guess we still have authority over that, do we not?
That is my understanding, yes.
Because it's not going to be like the railroad where, with a situation where you can pay someone X amount of money, and then the legislature doesn't have any control over that, which I think, as you know, was a big situation.
Quite a problem for us, yes.
Okay. Senator Dunn.
Chair, I don't mean to be picky on this area here, but... I guess the purpose of submitting a resolution to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee is so that we're informed, we know what's going on. Why shouldn't we also have them submitting that to the the legislature as a whole or to the finance committees, because during a session, for example, it's the finance committees that deal in this area, not LB&A. And I'm not sure
that's a good idea,
if there's language we should add there that says what the proper language would be, whether it be to the legislature or to the finance.
I agree with that.
Which way we would word that?
Could we word that, Mike, with to the Senate and House Finance Committee?
Well, if you want to be very specific about during session, it's submitted to the finance committees, and then during the term, it's submitted to the budget committee.
That would be my suggestion. Submit a resolution to the legislative budget and audit committee during the interim. However, during when the legislature is in session, the finance committee should be notified.
Yeah, maybe that's conceptual language. We could have the legal people draft it correctly, right?
But yes, I think it's a good idea, Mr. Duncan Part.
Is there objection to that? So ordered. Next, do you want to keep going along?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. On page 7, the question of the Procurement Act was dealt with, I think, very well. The starting in section 9, basically states that the railroad, Alaska, AHFC, and ASHA have the authority to adopt procedures that one, reflect competitive bidding principles and provide vendors reasonable and equitable opportunities to participate in the procurement process, and two, include procurement methods to meet emergency and extraordinary circumstances. I think this is very good language. Quite frankly, it's superior to the language in the procurement code, which we all know has a number of difficulties. Again, yourself and Senator Frank, Senator Binkley were very helpful in putting this language together, and I thank you for that. I think it's a very good approach.
Let me just double check with the railroad. For the record, will you come up and support that language, please? Thank you. Or they not support it or whatever, since you worked on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Larry Howell with the Alaska Railroad. On behalf of the Railroad Corporation, we are in support of this language in the bill to include the letter of intent that goes along with that. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm glad you mentioned that. There is a letter of intent that Ms. Adair has, and by the way, she did an excellent job in putting this together, and I have no objection to the letter of intent. In fact, I think it's a good expression of the committee's intent to travel with the legislation.
Now, of course, this does phase out the subsidy from $90,000 to $70,000, $70,000 to $50,000,
$50,000
to
$30,000.
Zero.
Yes, Mr.
Chairman. 4 years or 5 years?
4 years.
Okay. But, Mr.
Chairman. Senator Duncan.
That's for standard.
That is for the standard program. There still will be the low income program with up to with a $50,000 cap.
I got a briefing, and I don't know if the chairman of AHFC came around. I hope you'll have a chance to see everybody individually, and we had a nice chat about what was happening with AHFC. I think there's also from the members' interest, it'd be interesting to see the programs they're working on and the problems they're having with the lawsuit with MAGIC right now, and he could give you an update on that because it's forestalling some of their programs. So, is there any other questions on the bill, or is there anything else that needs to be explained on the bill?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify on committee?
Let me make one additional comment in the with regard to the two public members. Considerable discussion was given to designating someone from the financial community and someone who's a licensed real estate broker as the two. And I would it isn't in the draft, but I would recommend that to the committee.
Okay, let's take a look at that. What page?
That is on page 2, line 1. And where it says four public members rather than two will be appointed by the governor.
Your suggestion is to put in a specific...
The additional, we're adding two seats, and the two right. seats be designated as one from the financial community and two, someone who's a licensed real estate broker. This has been both the spoken and unspoken assumption of everyone who's dealt with this, and there is strong support in both our body and in our colleagues in the lower house.
And then one licensed real estate agent or what? How
you licensed real estate broker, Mr. Chairman.
I don't know if that's, I have sort of mixed feelings about that. I think one of the problems that we have sometimes with AHFC is the fact that we sometimes get all the opinions from the bond brokers, and I understand that's important for selling the bonds, but it sort of does skew our opinion toward things. So if it's
that's just my personal opinion on it, but Senator Frank.
Well, thank you. I guess when I think of a member of the financial community, I'm thinking of a local banker or mortgage company.
Banker, mortgage company, person,
credit union, as opposed to a representative of the New York bond market, for example. Although I suppose the governor could appoint one of those types as opposed to a local banker. But I think
bankers benefit from AHFC as well because of the
percentage. Oh, sure. And there's no that's recognized, but I think it also brings a perspective. I know that when we go homes to our districts, we hear complaints from the real estate community, from the banking community about how slow and inefficient AHFC is. And I think those are natural types of complaints, but I think it would help to give the perspective of the industries that are the most directly affected by AHFC some representation on the board. They certainly would not dominate the board, but they could bring a perspective to the board that I think would be helpful and valuable in making AHFC perhaps more responsive to the public at large. So I think it's a good idea. I would support that idea.
Mr. Chairman, I couldn't agree more with Senator Frank. The addition of someone from those two areas would go a long way towards dealing with some of the criticisms that have been leveled at AHFC with regard to their lack of understanding or their lack of detailed involvement in those two areas. Still, the public members would outweigh the private members, so in the event of any conflict of interest, apparent or real, the public members would always predominate.
Your suggestion is to...
We could say, if we wanted to focus in on the mortgage banking aspect, we could say a member of the financial community who engages in mortgage banking.
I don't want to say that.
You don't want to say that.
Okay. Well, let's
just say the
financial
community.
The financial community, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
right.
We got some mortgage bankers. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay. All right. Then, I
think that's being too specific about
okay,
it.
Okay, that's fine. I would say then I would move that we adopt a conceptual amendment along with our other conceptual amendment to include of the four. Actually, I guess what we'd do is change it to back to two and then say have two additional paragraphs
there.
You
don't have to change the language from four because you're automatically, if you add
it. Well, I think we change that back to two and then we'd add four and five, four being a member of the financial community and five being a member of, or a licensed real estate.
Or it could be four public members, one who shall be a licensed real estate broker, and one who shall be.
Yeah, that's true. Either way, we'll let our legal people do
it. Whoever legal people decide.
Do we have any legal people here to do that?
Senator Rohde's legal people.
Senator Rohde, I mean,
I've already been wrong once, so you may want to check into it.
It will be an official act of the Finance Committee, so she's got it down. Okay, so ordered. Anything else that has to be taken up on the bill? Thank you, Senator Rohde.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let's just check with Mary Halloran with the governor's office, make sure she's clued into what's going on here.
Oh, just to add in the budget committee
governor's
plus
office.
The finance committees.
Mr. Chairman,
the
only point that I'd like to make is on page 2 with a section that deals with HFC's ability to employ additional staff. Senator Duncan is correct. The executive does reserve that right itself constitutionally to determine the number of employees. What's really at issue here is the ability of the corporation to clearly expend additional funds beyond its approved operating budget without further action by the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the distinction that needs to be made here. Unfortunately, we've not crafted the language well, and as a result, there's some confusion, I think, about what's really at issue here. But it's we have the front section of the budget that says they can basically expend whatever funds they need in order to carry out the purposes of their chapter, yet you also have an operating budget for the agency. And there was some ambiguity about which of those two takes precedence, and we wanted a clear understanding on the part of the legislature that in the case of an emergency, they could expend funds beyond their operating budget with notification to legislative budget and audit. So it's...
Senator Duncan.
But what you're saying then, Mary, is they would still come back, the budget would still be submitted as part of the executive budget, but the language we need here is to make it clear that if, in a case of emergency, if they need to expend funds above that was approved in the budget, that they can do that and submit notification to the...
Exactly, exactly. It's not an issue of additional employees, it's an issue of additional funds. And I'm sorry that that hasn't been clear.
But again, it wouldn't be, we couldn't have veto power. They would just submit that for information. We could recommend they not do it, but they could do what they wanted to, I guess.
Well, my understanding that that is an area where you do certainly have veto power. It's an appropriation. It's a matter of appropriation, not a matter of how we allocate the appropriation.
Well, it's a matter of the Finance Committee has the veto power.
Yeah.
But Budget and Audit Committee, under the way we're presently structured, for example, when you folks receive more federal funds than what we do, a blanket appropriation for
right.
federal funds.
Right.
And when you're going to start a new program with those federal funds, you inform us through your RP, and we can either approve or disapprove. If we approve, you go ahead. If we disapprove, you can still go ahead. You just got to tell us why you went ahead.
And that's so, where we think probably the front section of the budget gives AHFC the same ability to kind of go ahead. But we wanted it to be a matter of clarity so that everybody understood what was at issue.
So what are you requesting here?
I'm not requesting anything, except I think that probably the language might be clearer than it is on its face right now, and just say simply the corporation may expend additional funds above its approved operating budget without obtaining prior approval by legislative budget on it. Then it's just very clear what's really at stake.
But then still require them to submit that information.
Yes, yes.
How does it work now, Mary?
We've never exercised that. We've never broken through that ambiguity in the current appropriations. So they've always stayed within their, as far as I know, and Bob Sullivan's probably better, can tell you better than I. As far as I know, they've never gone beyond their established operating budget.
Well, then what's the need to have them go ahead and use extra money? I mean, then we might as well exempt them from the Alaska Budget Act and everything else. I mean, why not leave it as it is? I don't know. Senator Frank?
I think Mary has a good point.
What's the purpose of it?
Well, she's getting to the heart of the issue, and the issue is whether or not they can expend additional funds, not whether or not they can hire another person within their existing authorized level of expenditure. I mean, they can hire, you know, 87 new people as long as they don't spend any new dollars to do so. And we do retain, the veto on the appropriation level. Or, you know, that's what we decide every year is how much money they spend,
right.
Not how many employees they
right.
hire.
I don't think we can get into the employees question, but I do think that it, as long as it's clear in the bill, that they what we go ahead and appropriate for them is what they get. Now, if you put in language in there that indicates they can expend more than that, then you're going to give them authority to do more, would you not?
Yeah. But let me ask
Senator Duncan.
I want to be sure I'm clear. In the front section of the budget, do we give a blanket appropriation for them to spend any amount of money that they may receive as far as...
The past, last year you did, and the language is still that way this year.
So despite what we set in their budget through the budget process,
right.
If we authorize them to spend X million dollars, they can spend X plus if they generate that extra revenue and determine, under the way we presently do it, and
yes.
determine that's the amount they should spend. So what you're asking for here is language that would make it clear that that authority exists. It's just clarification language.
It's clarification language that applies to the current situation, yes.
They have not, though, been doing that in the past.
No, they have not. And as a result, 1 year, as you know, all know, we lost a considerable amount of money. And it's to give them some flexibility in what are perceived to be emergency situations.
Okay. Senator Duncan, or Senator Frank.
Thank you. I got two questions and a clarification, I think. I think we put that information in the front section of the budget. Started doing that a few years ago when it became a question as to whether or not the interest earned on assets of the corporation went back to the corporation or whether they went to the general fund. And I don't think it was the intent at that time to authorize the corporation to hire new people, expend additional funds without legislative appropriation or approval. So I think that's why we did the front section. Now that's my comment. My question is, can you go ahead and The normal thing that you bring before the Budget and Audit Committee is a revised program for the expenditure of additional federal receipts. I mean, that's the most common. And we, the Budget and Audit Committee, if it disapproves, can, or the administration can go ahead and spend within 45 days, the way I understand it, and you don't have the authority to spend within that 45-day time period. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Okay. And so if you came in to with a revised program with general fund dollars...
Well, they're actually other program receipt, dollars. But
okay, program receipt dollars. Mm-hmm. Or let's just say you wanted to revise a program, you wanted to, you know, spend more money on road maintenance. You could not come to the, you could not do that through the normal, through the Legislative Budget Audit Committee RFP process, could you?
As I understand it now, no.
No, because it's general funds, not federal funds. And in this case, we're talking about other funds. We're talking about Alaska Housing Finance funds. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I'm a little unclear on the distinction and what are what the separation of power, or not the separation, but the delegation issue.
Hold it on.
I guess the court case, Legislature V. Hammond, got to the issue of whether or not the legislature could delegate its authority to appropriate to a committee, and it found that it could not. So in this case, I guess what we're doing is we're authorizing the corporation to expend funds from wherever they get them in any amount, and we're not giving any approval process to LBNA because we can't delegate that. We have to, in this manner, we have to authorize it as a full body and authorize it in the budget.
There's a question from the left-hand side of the table. Senator Fisher.
No, I guess what we're talking about, I agree with you. I don't think this is the vehicle to do that. I don't want to use this vehicle as the vehicle to do something. The way it is right now, I think it works pretty well. Now, you could say, well, really, they don't have to go to budget audit. But I think the fact that they do go to budget audit for a review, I think is very, very good. And to my knowledge, very seldom, if ever, did they ever go against what the budget audit folks recommended. Because I can recall Alaska Housing one hire what 80-something or 90-something new employees. That thing went back and forth until they finally had votes. And then they went ahead with it. So I think it's a good check and balance. So I might say it's ambiguous right now, but I think maybe that's the way to keep it so that they do at least come back to budget and audit and have the feeling that if budget and audit unanimously rejects something, that maybe they better do it.
Yep. Well, Senator Duncan.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm beginning to be convinced that we don't need Section 2 at all. That perhaps the way to keep it clearer is not to have Section 2 here. Because, for example, on positions, there's not a problem. The Budget and Audit Committee and the legislature as a whole cannot approve positions or disapprove positions. We did that with HFC before with special language that we had put on a conditional appropriation. And that's why HFC was coming back to us with their 72 new positions. If we don't do anything here, then they would work under, the LBNA guidelines, which are laid out in a separate statute. And it would then be a decision of the legislature. If we in the front section of the budget want to give them a blanket appropriation of all their funds, then they would follow the same process as anyone else. They would be able to go ahead and expend those. They would do the RP to the LBNA committee. We'd review it. If we didn't like it, they could do it anyway or whatever. It seems to me that we're perhaps confusing the issue by putting a section in here. What we really need to do is just not do anything and let the process work as it's supposed to work.
As long as everybody recognizes that the way you do have the language structured in the current budget does give them a great deal of flexibility. We wanted to make it clear
sure.
that flexibility existed so nobody was surprised if it's exercised.
Yeah. And then each year the finance committees, as they set the budget, if they make that blanket appropriation, they make that blanket appropriation. I don't see why we wouldn't be making that blanket appropriation.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if that causes problems with anybody, but it seems to me that everything is pretty well taken care of.
I don't want to speak for the corporation. I think maybe it's more appropriate for Bob to do that, but it's the difference between having the assurance that they can continue to operate in the future as a private corporation would and to be more flexible, or to have to repeat this exercise every year to make sure that the legislature that year wants them to operate as a private corporation.
What exercise?
Having to keep the front section language in the budget and keep it clean.
I think that they do have to repeat that exercise each year. I mean, I don't know that, in fact, I'm not even sure that this legislature could bind future legislatures to not putting that in the front section of the budget, no matter what we do in this statute.
That's true.
You know, we can say anything we want to in this statute, but the next legislature is going to appropriate those funds either specifically or in general. So I'm not sure that this can override what future legislatures can do. And it seems to me the best solution for HFC is to understand, as and I'm sure the executive would support them on this, that the creation of positions is within their right. The last time, the reason why they couldn't do that, as I understand, was because we made that appropriation conditional on them coming back to LBNA for approval of those positions, and that's what tied them up.
Mm-hmm.
And we really, you know, probably won't do that in the future. But you create positions as you want to create them, and they should be able to also, as long as they've got sufficient revenues to do that. And secondly, then, it's the decision of the legislature as a whole.
My suggestion, too, would be to take out Section B, unless there's an objection to that.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator, I know
that's where I started from.
I know.
I guess I got myself into the same old deal, you know. You get in there and you start compromising, and maybe we went too far. But this committee won't support that. You know, I guess I just have to admit that that's where I started. I think
what do you suggest? Well, I'm just saying, if you want to accomplish your ends, that's fine, but let's not muddy it up in the process. Is it possible to come up with a shortened version of that?
No, I think it's kind of a question of either or.
What do you suggest we do, Senator?
Well, I was comfortable with that, but I'm not going to die for it, because I think they have an adequate situation now, and I was just trying to come up with something that the committee could accept. If the committee doesn't like this, then I will go with the wishes of the committee.
Senator Duncan.
With no offense.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's not that I don't like it, except that we're talking about employees here in this section only, and that's really not a problem.
I hear you.
It's not the problem. So Mary suggested if we're really talking about revenues, we should address that. And I don't believe, again, I'm not an attorney, but I don't believe that we can say in this statute that all future legislatures will appropriate in any certain way unless you exempt them from the Executive Budget Act, right? And we're not doing that. So I don't think it's, I think it's not useful language. It's probably perhaps more confusing than anything else. But the process we have now is clear, and it's been working for a number of years, and we should just leave it that way and delete Section 2. And I'm not trying to cause HFC a problem. I don't know if Mr. Sullivan's position on this. Maybe he'd like to...
Mr. Sullivan, could you address this section quickly? Because it did go to the subcommittee, I will support the subcommittee chairman on the any kind of a change on it. Senator Senator Sullivan.
Thank you. I think it's fair and appropriate to say, as far as Alaska Housing is concerned, we do believe that there is a necessity for some clarity of definition, quite frankly. And although verbal intentions are fine, but sometimes down the road they get lost in the shuffle, so to speak. And let me cite what might be a potential rationale for what we're speaking to at this point. As I'm sure the committee is aware, we are currently involved in filing a lawsuit, a rather large and very potentially serious lawsuit with one of our mortgage insurers. At this point in time, none of us can speak to what the outcome of this may or may not be. But along the way, there's certainly a possibility that perhaps as early as this summer, that certain insurance claims, certain other allegations, whatever, to include the potential of not writing any mortgage insurance, this could happen. I'm not suggesting it will by any stretch of the imagination. But if this should occur, we are going to find ourselves in a position where we have to move rather quickly. And there's a distinct possibility that a likelihood of hiring claims experts, if you will, in a hurry to get some things done, this could occur. Now, I would hope you don't construe this as a scare tactic, because I don't at all mean this, and besides which, as I present this, it's obviously hypothetical at this point. We are unclear, quite frankly, as to the ability to respond and react quickly. And all we're asking for is a definition, as perceived by this and or other committees, to allow us to do this. I've heard lots of conversation here, but I still believe that we are a little bit uncertain. We believe it's murky, and we believe we'd like some clear definition as to what we may or may not be able to do in this regard. And that's the purpose
and
of this.
And it's my understanding that that's, you worked with the subcommittee to come up with this, did you not?
That is correct, Mr.
Senator Duncan.
But Mr. Chairman, I'm concerned we're making it more murky than instead of less murky, Mr. Sullivan. I'm not trying to create a problem, but for example, in the front section of budget now, section 14 reads, all unrestricted mortgage loan interest payments and all other receipts, including without limitation mortgage loan commitment fees received by or accrued, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, are appropriated to the Alaska Housing Finance Revolving Fund for the purposes described in AS 1856. That gives you complete flexibility to spend all those monies you receive, whether or not we've recognized that amount in your formal budget presentation or not. That gives you blanket authority to use any of those receipts. And if it's to fill new positions, you can use it to fill new positions. If it's to do whatever else, you can use it to do whatever else. That language is very specific. My concern is that if we put in this statute that you have, that you can use any receipts you generate, and don't then somewhere down the line next year give you that blanket appropriation in the front section of budget, I think we've got a real problem. It'd be my opinion that the budget appropriation would override any language you have in the statute, and then you would have a problem of non-clarity. Seems to me that the best thing we can do for you year after year is to do that blanket appropriation, and it's clear from that language you've got the ability to use that money however you want to use it. And if we put in here language which doesn't override an appropriation, I think you're walking into some muddy waters, is my opinion. And because the appropriation, I think, would override this language. If, no matter what this bill says, if we don't appropriate all your receipts, you're not going to be able to use them.
I certainly can't debate, nor would I choose to debate that point, Senator Duncan. But if I understand what I'm hearing, that appropriation and those funds are available for use any way the corporate, in effect, any way the corporation chooses to use them, if that is completely and thoroughly understood by all, then we have no basis of argument on this point, and I agree with you.
As long as the legislature does that in the front section of budget, to me, that's clear and gives you the authority. If the legislature decides not to do that in the front section of budget, then I think you've got a problem that even this language wouldn't overcome.
Under that set of circumstances, I would be inclined to concur with your thoughts and your voice comments, Senator Duncan.
So, Mr. Chairman, just in summary, because I know we want to get this out here, I really think Section 2 should be deleted for clarity's sake.
Senator Frank, I'm going to support your motion to keep it. If there's a motion to take it out, I'm going to support the way the subcommittee came up with it.
Well, I guess I'd
Senator
like
Rohde
to,
may want to comment on that. I don't like know to how strongly to, he feels about that.
Yeah,
I think the sponsor should, of the bill.
Right, that's what
Senator
I
Rohde, how do you feel about that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan is quite correct that the front part of the budget does give AHFC authority to expend the monies. They have never, in respect to the legislature, they've never done that because they haven't because it is unclear. You have whether you have this language or not, you still have a problem, and that is you have allocations that are made in the budget plus the front end of the budget language. AHFC has never pressed the point because they did not want to anger the legislature. We really do have a dilemma even without this language. This language, and I'm not the author of it, and tried to solve that problem, and we need to make a definitive statement of how we wish the corporation to deal with, and I think we all know where we want to go, and that is allowing AHFC to put on the necessary positions to deal with the management tasks that they have and are able to respond in a rational way. We're constrained by the to some extent by the Executive Budget Act and by the lack of clarity between the language in the front of the budget and whatever allocations are made in the budget itself. I don't have an answer, Mr. Chairman.
Well, maybe I think the answer is to delete Section 2, but maybe there's something else we could do, and maybe it takes a little more time, but maybe we could leave the language in that makes it clear that they can employ additional employees, and maybe we could also say they may also expend any amount of money that's, they may expend without the total amount of money that's appropriated by the legislature, which would be, I mean, I don't know how the wording would be, but if we did a blanket appropriation, then it would be clear they could spend all that money that was appropriated open-endedly. I think it just gets more confusing, but maybe there's some language there that would give them some comfort. And again, I still think it remains up to the Finance Committee each year as to how much they want to appropriate to AHFC. And if we do the blanket appropriation, they can spend every dime that's there. If we don't do it, they can only spend what we appropriate. And I guess all you're looking for is assurances that you can spend what we appropriate. All you got to do is take us to court and you'll win.
Thank you.
We've lost those cases forever, right? You guys can spend whatever we appropriate.
And the next year they won't get anything.
Senator,
excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Frank.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I haven't been as started out not willing to remove HFC from the discipline of having to go before the LB&A committee. They have not exercised the authority that they have by law. They have, I guess, not wanted to get into a argument with the legislature. They have wanted to work with the legislature in getting approval. Mm-hmm. And as Senator Fisher points out, I think there is some very real validity in this, in this process. I think it's, obviously incumbent upon the legislature to respond to their requests in a timely fashion. I think that's what they've got problems with. They didn't get a timely response. They got a six-month argument, and I think that's the problem we're trying to cure, and whether we want to throw the baby out with the bathwater or not is kind of the question. Do we want to reject the process because it failed to work once, or do we want to perhaps in some fashion make note of the fact that the process can work if the legislature falls through in good faith and lets it work in the proper fashion. I think that's kind of the heart of the
Senator
problem.
Chair, of course, we're talking about two different processes here. The LB&A process, as it's presently set up in statute, didn't necessarily fail. The reason, as I understand it, you had problems before the six-month delay is we had really kind of made a conditional, I think it was conditional language on the appropriation that said, before you put on those 72 guys, you got to come back and get approval. That's not normal. That was something separate. Normally, the LB&A process would be the 45-day processes in other statutes. I think that's why you had such a long delay before, is because we did something entirely different, which I guess was legal, but I really...
I mean, one suggestion is we could leave it in there as it is, and then if there is some kind of a problem on it, it can be deleted at a later time. That would be...
The other suggestion would be to do a letter of intent to make clear what their concerns are.
Senator Pierce, Senator Fisher.
That's reasonable. We could. I would be willing to work with Mr. Chenoweth and Ms. Adair to research the problem and then at the leisure of the members.
Senator Fisher.
No.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm not sure where we are now. We've been taking it out.
Senator Pierce.
Well, I would support taking it out, but doing a letter of intent, as Mr. Duncan.
Okay, why don't we, is that...
I'm comfortable with that, yeah.
Okay, then we will take Section B out. Will you make a motion to do that?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we remove Section 2.
Okay. Any objections? So ordered. And there will be a letter of intent that we're going to adopt conceptually, then that will include Senator Frank's and Pierce's concerns in regard to Budget and Audit Committee. Will you come up with a letter on that?
Yes.
How's that?
Well, I think the concern that you want to address there is a specific concern that AHFC has the ability to create positions within their level of appropriation. They also have the ability to spend whatever is appropriated by the legislature each year, whatever. We want to clarify that they work like an administrative agency.
To expend appropriation and unallocated monies.
Right, yeah.
But we are not... leading them from the LB&A process.
No. They would follow the process just like any other agency would follow.
Why don't you draft that up?
Senator Rody.
Why don't you work on that, the three of you? Is there any other objections, Senator Frank? Do you want to move the bill out then?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would.
Senator Pierce?
I was just going to remind everybody that there is already one letter of intent that we'll be adding to.
Okay.
We want to make sure we move it.
Yeah. That's a good point. We'll just add to it then.
Okay, we will pass the bill out, but of course we get the letter in town, we can't read it across, and so.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I would move that we pass out, or that we, yeah, we've already adopted it, so pass out CS for Senate Bill number 427, finance as amended.
Okay. There's no objection, so ordered. We are running out of time this morning. Carol, how much time do we have left? They've rung the bells already. Mr. Snowden, I know you have to go back to Anchorage tomorrow. Is that what someone told me? Well, I want to continue down the calendar. That's where I want to go. It's just that we've been working on this AHSC bill for some time.
Possibly, you might reach me in the morning then.
Oh yeah, we'd like to stop. We'd like to continue where we left off.
I will,
Carol.
I'll try to hook myself on the TV by tomorrow. I'll stay overnight. That's all right.
Thanks. How many other people to test tonight? Just yourself?
I do. Yeah.
Can I talk to some other people?
No, that's fine. You can talk to
me. Your question about a conflict between the state being required to participate and keeping exempted.
Okay, let's get started this morning. Today is March 16th, 1990. Today is Friday. It's about 10 after 9. Those present this morning are Senator Fisher, Senator Duncan, and Senator Frank. The first bill on the calendar will be Senate Bill number 332 on missing children, and let's see if there's anybody here to testify on it. I'll give a brief introduction on the bill. The bill is in its third committee of referral, and it essentially is a piece of legislation to aid law enforcement agencies attempting to locate missing children. And obviously it's hard to imagine that there's anything more devastating to a family than to know that their child is missing. Senate Bill 332 requires the Department of Public Safety to have records of missing children flagged at Alaska schools and the Bureau of Vital Statistics so that subsequent attempts to claim records of that child will alert the authorities. This legislation will not guarantee the recovery of missing children, but it will make it much harder for child abductors to put missing children into Alaska schools. The State Affairs Committee put together a committee substitute, which essentially I concurred with as a member of the State Affairs Committee, and there's backup information on the changes that were made on it. It essentially tightened up the bill. There were some suggestions by the Department of Public Safety and Health and Social Services to make the bill work, and I believe we have Steve Hall here with the Department of Education. Did you wish to testify on the bill? Okay, unless there's any questions. You're in support of the bill as you were, I guess, in State Affairs, are you not? Okay. The bill has a zero fiscal note on it. How about anybody from Health and Social Services that wishes to testify on the bill? Okay, thank you very much. There's zero fiscal notes are in your packet from State Affairs, or I should say from Health and Social Services and from the Department of Public Safety. And this is the third committee referral. Any questions?
Yeah, I have a question.
Sure. Senator Duncan.
Mr. Hole, please. Mr. Hull, this on school records, this applies public and private schools.
Through the chair, Senator Duncan, in the State Affairs Committee, there were two amendments proposed which would make it very clear that the bill applies to private schools, both those which are exempt under 1445-100 and others. Those amendments were defeated. So I guess, from my perspective, if it's going to apply to private schools, it will require either an amendment or a regulation from the Department of Education, which makes that application very clear, because right now it is not. There is no reference to those schools which have exempt status under that statute.
Senator Duncan.
What is your recommendation? Should it apply to private schools? Should it be done by statute, or how do you prefer it to be done? I don't know what the chairman's preference is, because it's his bill, but I was just wondering.
Senator Duncan, my preference is just to leave it as it is. There was an amendment in the State Affairs Committee, and it failed, and there was a requirement in there, but there was also a time requirement that was put in there. So my concern was, and the other members of the committee's concern was, that the amendment just didn't fit into the bill.
I guess I don't understand for sure why. So what we're doing then is if a child who goes to a private school is abducted, they can go to school. I mean, their records could be... they could be re-enrolled in another school, their records could be obtained, and no one would ever know it. But
well,
if they're a public school student, then they...
Actually, the statute has been silent on it, and I don't think we're changing anything in this. Steve?
Mr. Chairman,
I'd have to look at the amendment again. It was in the State Affairs Committee, and it pertained to... Go ahead, Steve.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, the amendment, which was defeated, amended 1445-100, which is the section on religious and other exempt schools, and made it clear that this requirement attached to those schools. Absent that amendment, there is some question. It certainly is silent in the statute. In my judgment, if this requirement is going to apply to those schools, it will require either a statutory amendment or a regulation.
And my suggestion would be that if there's an amendment on the floor or something, that's fine. We can certainly look at it at that time, although, in state affairs there wasn't any. Didn't pass.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know. I just looked at the bill. It just seemed to make sense to me that it should be any school record, but it's your bill and...
it was looked at very carefully.
DOE doesn't seem to... Can you do it by regulation, I guess? You can?
Yes, sir, we can do it by regulation.
Any other questions, Senator Fisher?
No.
You bet. Go ahead. Yeah. Any objections? So ordered. A zero fiscal note. Next bill will be, we're going to skip down here to Senator Curtula's bill because Senator Duncan's been working on that. And Kathy Hathaway, did you want to come to the table in case we have any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Duncan.
Chairman, I think you have in your packet a proposed Finance Committee substitute for 335. It should be dated, I think, the date 31390. Work Order 6-1615J is the correct bill. Actually, there's only three changes that we're recommending from the bill that was brought into the committee and what we're recommending reported out as a committee substitute. If I could run through those very quickly.
Sure.
The first is on page 13. Page 13, line 29, would be the last line down there. We are changing, it says, except as provided in D&E of this section, the deposit amount for health maintenance organization that begins operation after the effective date of this act is a greater of, it used to be 5%, and we're changing it to 10%. And what the changes, the three changes we're doing here, what they would do is increase protection for creditors of an Alaskan HMO in the event such an organization should become insolvent. And these changes would apply to HMOs established before and after the effective date of the act. So that change from 5 to 10%, then on page 14, on line 3, where it talks about it used to have $100,000. We increased that to $250,000. And on the same page, line 17, it was $100,000, and that's been increased to $250,000. And again, that's just for protection, to increase protection of creditors of the Alaskan HMO. And my understanding is the sponsor actually, in agreement with this, recommended those changes. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And then on page 27, everything else up to page 27 is the same. And on page 27, beginning on line 13, we deleted some language and added some language. Let me read you the language that was deleted. After the comma, after unit, we deleted, the collective bargaining agreement shall provide for the health maintenance organization enrollment option required by this subsection, and replace it with the language you see there that says the option of enrollment in a health maintenance organization shall first be submitted to the bargaining representative of the bargaining unit. If the option is approved by the bargaining representative, the option of enrollment shall then be made to each represented employee. So we would just straighten out the problem with collective bargaining. Instead of mandating something into a collective bargaining agreement, we were saying it should be submitted as part of the as a proposal to the organization, and then they could either include that or not include that in the agreement that they should negotiate.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. It's my understanding that this mirrors the language that's contained in federal regulations. Dave Williams from Health and Social Services is here, and I'm sure he could answer any questions about it if there are any.
Mr. Williams, did you want to come forward for a minute in case we have any questions?
Could I go to the last change?
Sure.
And then we can. And then the last change on the bill is on page 29, line 6. Page 29, line 8, following the word shall, we insert the language comply with the dual choice requirements of AS 2186310 and shall, and that was actually a change proposed by the drafter, and it was to ensure that there was no problem with the dual choice provisions. Here. And those were the only changes we made in the bill.
Senator Duncan, I believe what this does is allows there to be a choice with the bargaining unit where there would not be if the bill passed as it was.
With the original language, if you're referring to page 27, line 13, it said in the original language that the collective bargaining agreement shall provide for health maintenance organization enrollment option required with the subsection. So you were mandating something into a collective bargaining agreement. The new language says that the option of enrollment in an HMO shall first be submitted to the bargaining representative of the bargaining unit, and then if that's approved, the option of enrollment shall then be made to each represented employee. So you don't mandate it as part of the agreement, you put it on the table as something they can negotiate, and then if it's part of the contract, part of the agreement, it should be made available to each employee. And that, I believe, straightens out the problem that at least I saw in the collective bargaining area. Perhaps others can respond to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Dave Williams from the Department of Health and Social Services. And we're aware of the revisions suggested and identified by Senator Duncan and agree with all of them. This particular change that's being looked at right now did used to say shall. It was our intention that it did reflect what's required by the federal government in order for Medicaid to participate with an HMO. And this language is a mirror of that. And the other was more restrictive than necessary, so we're quite in agreement on it.
What's the likelihood of us getting to a situation where we do have HMOs in Alaska? Are we pretty close to that?
Not to my knowledge. Our interest is if an HMO is started, mm-hmm. we want to be able to take part in the benefits that would flow from an HMO, not be excluded from that.
Senator Duncan and Kathy.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just respond. I talked with Mr. Malik, who, of course, is a consultant of the Healthcare Task Force, and the indications are there's not going to be a great rush to HMOs in this state. But it's worth having it on the books in case and having the guidelines there in case they do come about. But at least the indications we got is it doesn't look like there will be a great rush towards the HMO concept.
Kathy?
That's basically my understanding, too.
Okay. Senator Duncan?
Mr. Chairman, we lost our
we lost our quorum here, so we'll just continue to discuss until. Senator Fisher?
No, I have a question on the dual choice. Can.
Okay.
When we talk about, I don't know why we're at this place. I mean, it seems to me that the organizations out there is a good thing to have. The employer and employee independently will make some decision to go that way. But they, for example, section 128 says this section does not apply to an employer and employee who is residing in an area where health care services are not provided by a And what that gets into is quantity and quality. You could have a healthcare organization, which is really the service are almost nil, but it is an organization. Or the quantity is not good, whatever. And here you now have something that they have to consider. Some employer out there might decide, well, we're going to go with that one, it's cheaper. And the employees that don't get the benefits they should get because they opt to join something that's cheaper. Because the services are really good. I guess the dual choice, I don't see why you need it at all. Force them to choose it. If it's good, they will choose it. If it's not good, they won't.
Mr. Williams.
This is Dave Williams. The way this arose was back in, even in the 60s and early 70s, when HMOs were a new thing and had not been, didn't have much prominence. And this kind of language arose back on the East Coast as a way to promote HMOs. Anymore, it's in there more to make sure that an employee has an option, if an HMO is available to them, to take something which is, provides the services they desire, but at a lower cost. The dual choice is now, remains in here for federal participation. The concern that Department of Health and Social Services has is that some of these HMOs, if we didn't have this language, might start up and begin offering services that are eligible for payment under our medical assistance program to folks who are eligible for those services. And it could be 2 or 3 years later that the federal government comes in and notifies us that those folks are out of compliance with federal requirements for an HMO, therefore all those payments are invalid and need to be returned. That's what our concern really is here. And also on the other side of it, if there is a big HMO starts up in this state, the department wouldn't want to see medical assistance not be a part of that necessarily or excluded from it, because there is a possibility of cost shifting if you've already stated your price for services not yet rendered and then find that you don't have enough. Because of the way we pay Medicaid, we pay on the basis of the costs and a share of patient days or...
I guess the concern is something. If you took the whole section out on dual choice...
Which page are you on?
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm on page 27. I don't see how that section does anything with what you're saying. Just saying here, the way I read it, that you have to give the option out there if they want it. What's that have to do with?
Just simply that that is one of the federal requirements that's often raised by the feds at Healthcare Financing Administration as being one that has to be provided for in order to have compliance HMOs with Medicaid provisions that are federal in nature. Is one that's been raised in other states, as dual choice has to be assured in order to qualify as an HMO that meets Medicaid requirements. And you could offer dual choice and become and satisfy the federal requirement, but without it in state law, we have no assurances as the state administering Medicaid that all those things have been met. In other words, if it wasn't in here, somebody could be receiving Medicaid, but we'd have no assurance that they actually were in compliance, because there'd be no state law that required that performance to meet Medicaid standards.
You mean to tell me, to the chair, that just because we have a thing that says if there's a HMO in an area, you at least have to consider that's the key, even though it seems pretty loose, base everything on Medicaid payments, someone knows you do that option. The option is there, anyhow, there's no take care.
What this law is saying is that if the HMO is there, then the employer needs to make that an option for his employees to consider. And that's right out of the federal regulations.
So, Mr. Chairman, if we can assume the pick on Meyer because there's going to be an HMO established, and you have a private company out there that has 25 employees and they have a policy now, which they're paying for, and they're completely happy. Now they've got to go to their employees and say, do you want the HMO or not? They say, yeah, we want the HMO, and the employer says, no, we're not going to pay for it. And this is something we're doing just as a benefit to you folks, and we're not going to give you services in HMO, which we're not convinced is going to give the same service. So therefore, you're off the insurance policy.
My reading of the new language is that it would have to be offered if it's either to a bargaining unit or to the employees.
No,
it would have to be offered. It'd have to be offered, but my reading is it would have to be offered as an option, but not absolutely. There's no requirement that that be the method used, be offered to the employees.
It just seemed like it's gave and words. I don't see any substance in it. What happens if it's offered? Not accepted or accepted.
Employees have had the choice. I believe that's meant the dual choice.
The employer now is paying everything. It's not a collective bargaining agreement. This is just a company that's a very small company political pressure from the local position to say, hey, man, we've got to get in this thing. But if they're not going on, the employer may just decide they're not going to get in.
I believe your concern is exactly why we changed the language here, was that it was reading that it had to be in a bargaining agreement. But that's why it's been changed, that to clarify that it's an option that has to be offered. In other words, the employer is not going to rule that one out on their own. They'll offer it up and discuss it with the employees as an option, a way to purchase health care.
Okay, maybe in the beginning of line four, in the beginning of the section, it says nothing about it, but it just says an employer, which means all employers. The only difference is when you get down to line 13, now they're saying if they are a member of the collective bargaining. In other words, all employers are covered under this thing. However, if they are a member of the collective bargaining agreement, now it's up to the bargaining representative to decide whether or not it's an employer. All those that aren't in the collective bargaining agreement system,
excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Fisher. I believe that it would be in the employer's best interest to offer the option of an HMO because HMOs are generally less expensive. And then the employee would be the one who decides which are the best benefits. Going to them. In addition, the next section makes it very clear that the employer is not required to offer an HMO or to pay for any higher cost for an HMO than that employer would have to do for whatever health plan they'd already been offering. So first of all, it seems to me that first of all you're looking at the employer's economic interest. And then the employee is the one who decides which benefits are better, as far as they're concerned.
Yeah, I just don't see it that way. I just think
that
if an employer, I'm thinking of a small company, has a benefit, I mean, if he's throwing that out as just something that he just gives him out of the generosity of his heart, then that should be up to him entirely, not the employee to say, well, but they don't have a collective bargaining agreement. What we're saying is here, through law, we're probably giving them that bargaining agreement on this issue. So I say maybe we shouldn't do that. If they don't have an agreement, maybe we should encourage them to get one.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Fisher, there are also representatives of the Department of Commerce here, possibly. It's my understanding that in addition to the reasons that Dave mentioned, that another reason for this was to ensure the economic viability of HMOs. So I think there's probably a dual reason for the dual choice provision, but possibly the Department of Commerce can answer more specifically.
Let's hear from Commerce here then also.
We're not mandating a collective bargaining here anymore. We're not mandating a collective bargaining here. Fisher, it's not worth it. Let it go. It's not going to work anyway. It's not going to work anyway. Just let it go.
Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dave Walsh from the Division of Insurance, and with me is Don Cope, also from Insurance. I think that Senator Fisher, if I may respond to his question, brings up an interesting point that I guess a set of circumstances could arise where it would probably occur, but I think that a more likely result is that it wouldn't, because the purpose here is, of course, to make HMOs viable, but it seems that the bill, as it's written now, to our way of thinking, provides a necessary check and balance, so that neither the employer nor the employee has the ability to call the tune to the other's disadvantage. The employer, according to paragraph A, must provide the choice, but under paragraph B, is not obligated for any additional cost. So I think that the likely result in
virtually every case, is that an employer would essentially gets the best of both worlds, and the employees do too. Each side gets an option. Neither side is responsible for additional costs. Both sides benefit from any reduction in cost. And I think that it's possible for a set of circumstances to occur under which, for essentially non-economic reasons, an employer may desire not to go with an HMO and to keep other type of coverage. And there is no question that this bill does not allow for those non-economic considerations. And arguably it shouldn't, because once, either as regulators or as legislators, any one of us starts to get into those kinds of reasons, it gets into a swamp from which there is no return. This bill, however, sets up, I think, sufficient checks and balances for a commercially reasonable decision on both sides. And beyond that, I don't think there is far that at least we as regulators can go.
Senator Fisher, do you want to continue
your
questioning?
Let me just ask, give you the case of a small employer who has 26 employees. He now has one out there who is wrong for $300 a month. And so this HMO convinced that we can go up to $300 a month. The employer doesn't want to go with that, but the employees do. And we won't.
Then the employees have the right to choose that option.
So then you do have to fight the bargaining situation.
Well, not collective bargaining in
not
the...
collective.
I'm sorry, Senator?
I'm sorry, it wouldn't be collective. It would be the employees telling the employer what kind
of coverage goes to the fund. Well, go ahead, Don.
If I may, through the chair.
Mr. Don Koch from the Division of Insurance.
My name is Don Koch. I'm acting deputy director of the Division of Insurance. An employer in that situation could still buy his Blue Cross policy, and the HMO would be the provider. In other words, the HMO would have to be something that Blue Cross recognizes when it's making its payments. So the option the employee has is, do I go to the HMO, which is included as an option, or do I go to this doctor down the street or this hospital across the street for my services? Blue Cross then indemnifies that provider. So the HMO in this case is really not competing with Blue Cross. They become a another provider out there that Blue Cross can deal with. What this structure in law is saying is that Blue Cross, if that's where your policy is, has to recognize this HMO, if there's one in the area, in its contract. In other words, they'd have to recognize that as a provider, but they wouldn't have to recognize it if the cost were greater than the other physicians in the area. At least they'd only have to recognize it to that degree. So there's an economic reason for them to recognize it.
Senator Fisher?
The HMO, I see it, is going to be an organization made by doctors getting together and informing their own quote menu of services, which is going to be most likely, I say, will be covered under Blue Cross anyway. And I don't think this will do that. The difference is that the HMO's an idea. They're saying, well, for our insurance program, it's $600 a month for enrollment. The disadvantage is if you're down in Seattle and you get sick, you're out. Whereas on Blue Cross, you're in, because it's recognized nationally. So I don't see how the HMO's are going to get the business anyhow. The person who has Blue Cross bills are going to go there. I don't think Blue Cross is going to say, well, we're not going to allow that HMO. They don't say that to doctors. So if you have a shield out there, Blue Cross is going to pay.
Is there a response for that?
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Senator, sorry. Dave Walsh.
Thank you for the promotion, Mr. Chairman. through the chair, I think that it's a legitimate point that at some step along this process, the decision shifts from a total employer decision
to either a joint decision between the employers and the employees, or I think even arguably a decision that each employee makes. I guess my view is I don't see that as substantially diminishing an employer's rights. If the coverage is the same and the cost is the same, then an employee, then it seems to me that it would make no difference to an employer whether they buy from column A or column B. If the cost is more, the employer doesn't get stuck with it. If the cost is less, the employer realizes the benefit. And if the coverage isn't equal, then in my view, the option isn't there. This is these two paragraphs basically only come into force when all of those requirements are met. And if one or the other isn't, then dual choice is not an issue. Senator Fisher?
I guess there's no penalty clause, I guess. So if an employer decides, I don't want any more bureaucratic tape. Nobody's telling me what to do. I'm going to just continue to do my own thing. There's no time to be taken. We're going to say, well, employer, we're going to have mining because you didn't get any more. Or you did my correct. There's no time to be created. Of course, the employer didn't do this.
I'm not aware of one. Yes, okay.
Okay, is that all the questions for our panelists today? Thank you very much for coming down here to Juneau. I guess you're all here in Juneau. So. Senator Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move the I'd move adoption of Finance Committee substitute, Senate Bill 335. I don't think we've adopted it.
There's a motion to adopt the committee substitute for sponsor substitute for 335. Is there objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I would move CES for sponsor substitute, Senate Bill 335, and I guess we've got zero fiscal notes on it.
Zero fiscal notes. The bill moves. Any objections? Next bill on the calendar is a bill sponsored by Senator Fakes. Is Senator Fakes here today?